If you'd like to support this podcast, please check out our support us page at asymmetricalhaircuts.com.
Yes, do buy us a coffee on Patreon. That way you also get to hear our special War Criminals Book Club recordings with our fellow international justice reporter, Molly Quell.
He steadfastly insisted that he was guilty, quote, only of aiding and abetting in the commission of the crimes with which he was charged, that he himself had never committed an overt act. And like, I think I could have written that sentence basically for every single defense of a suspect I have ever covered in any trial in any court for like war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity.
It's often a bit of a riot.
And sometimes it's a serious discussion about books, and sometimes not, and sometimes films. And we'll pick things that portray the worlds of international courts and war crimes.
And it's only on Patreon.
Come find us there.
That is what perpetrators do. They deny the fact that they're perpetrators. All of them see themselves as protecting their fatherland, fighting for a better world, doing the right thing.
Medieval crimes are being committed.
I come with clean hands.
Victims of horrific crimes want justice.
We don't have anything better than this.
This is Asymmetrical Haircuts, your international justice podcast, with Janet Anderson and Stephanie van den Berg.
All rise.
Hi, Steph.
Hi, Janet.
So we have at least once a year a regular podcast that we just have to do. It's one of those itches we have to scratch.
And tell me what it is, because I'm dying for this podcast.
Well, we always have to do a podcast on perpetrators. I mean, it's just this fascinating topic and one where you get amazing insights from people. And it's not exactly the same as our bread and butter stuff covering the war crimes trials.
Yeah, we had podcasts like this with Barbara Hola and with Shell Anderson. And Janet has suggested that the alternative title for this podcast is The Return of the Bosnian Waiter. And we'll get to that later, but it's one of my favorite questions and stories of perpetrators. But this time, we are lucky to be joined by Alette Smulders. Hi, Alette.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So Alette is a professor of international crimes in Groningen, and she's written a book on types of perpetrators, and she's been making a podcast on perpetrators, which we do thoroughly recommend to people to listen. And it's called, quote, Terribly and Terrifyingly Normal, and then it has a question mark at the end. So Alette, that's the first question. It's got normal in the title, but there's this question mark afterwards. And I'm sure we'll get into later sort of where this quote comes from. But just to start with, are perpetrators just like you and me? Are they, quote, normal?
Yes, most perpetrators are normal. And that is why I said terribly and terrifyingly normal, because it is a bit terrifying and scary to be aware of that. The question mark is there because not all perpetrators are normal. There are some perpetrators who are quite different from us, who are deranged, very violent, sadistic. So those perpetrators are not very normal or not very similar to us, but many of them are.
Can you explain here also that not all perpetrators are the same? Most are normal, but the social context really pushes them to do extraordinary things in the not good way. Can you give us some examples of how that plays out or where that happened?
Yes. Well, it happens in all situations and all cases that the context plays such a crucial role. And I distinguish the political, ideological, and organizational or social context. Political context means in a situation of conflict, rebellion, fighting, political upheaval when mass atrocities occur. So that is one part of it, that we are affected by that. Then within that political context, you have a very distinctive ideological context where as soon as you have a political conflict, very often the two groups start to see each other as us versus them. Then the us is good, legitimized, well, the good people who go against the bad people, the them group. So they very clearly define us as good, them as evil. And then they portray the entirely differences and the fight between them, between us versus them, good versus evil, where they, by definition, are good. So that's the second part of the context. The third one is the organizational or social context. And that is most perpetrators are members of militarized organizations. So they operate in a context, an organization in which obedience, conformity, loyalty are all extremely important and affects their behavior. There are some exceptions of perpetrators who are not part of these militarized groups, but then the whole social context pushes them to follow the group, to do as they're told, to accept the ideological us versus them, and to, yeah, protect themselves and fight for a better world, because that is what perpetrators believe they are doing.
It does sound a little bit like, justifications, like the social context made me do it. The social context made me start to believe these things. Is that how you see it?
Yes and no. It's fairly typical lawyer's comment. Isn't that just an excuse? Yes, in a way it is. And no, it is not. Because the context does strongly affect our behavior. And from a more social psychological perspective, understand behavior, we have to see behavior within a certain context. And we are very much determined and influenced by our context. So yes, it does play a very big role. And a lot of our behavior can be understood only if we understand the context. The other side of it is that we're not passive automatons. And that will be my response to the lawyer's comment, isn't it just an excuse? Because within the context, we still have a certain level of freedom and we still make choices. So the behavior of perpetrators is to a large extent determined by the context, but not entirely and not fully. They also make choices, and these choices make them transform into perpetrators, as I call it. So there's still this interrelation or interaction between the context and the individual, the situational factors and the dispositional factors.
It does sound like you get a bit fed up with the lawyers. I mean, I understand you're a criminologist, but you understand international law, but do you get fed up with that critique from lawyers?
No. It's just that I'm making it clear that there is a different perspective. I'm not a lawyer by training, but I did my PhD in international criminal law. So I'm a part of my research is really in law. But I see these two sides. And I just wanted to emphasize that lawyers versus social scientists have different ways of looking at it. And what I also try to do in my research is bridging the gap and make lawyers better understand what the relevance of social science is, but also the reverse, make social scientists understand the importance and relevance of the law.
To prepare for this podcast yesterday, I watched the little clip of you that's on YouTube where you're explaining your research, which has some very snazzy montages of horrible atrocities. And my son walked in and was kind of like, oh my God, POV, your mother likes war crimes. Why are you watching this? And so I also wondered what made you want to start studying perpetrators. We look at these war crimes, we tend to shy away from looking really too closely at the people who did that or trying to understand why they do things. How did you get to this point where you wanted to study them?
I read when I was young, I read books about the Dutch resistance in the Second World War because I found it very exciting and it was nice to read and I found it interesting. And my father is very interested in history and both my parents lived through the Second World War. So I was very intrigued by the Second World War. But in those books, obviously, the resistance is seen as the good people. And I started to think, if ever there is a war, I want to be like them. They were my heroes, my youth time heroes. But then at some point, I started to think whoever would want to be the Nazi in this context, the bad person, the evil person. And that triggered me so much that I started to ask questions as, who are these people? And then my first answer was, well, most of them are very ordinary people, just like you and me, the way we started off this podcast. And that intrigued me. I said, well, how and under what circumstances would I be able to do that, what they do? And that got me started off the research. And initially it was a general interest, but then at some point I was like, this is really what I want to do and start my research on. So really understand why people can come to commit such horrible crimes, especially knowing that they're fairly ordinary people. So then I thought it must be some strong factors in the environment and how we'd respond to that. And the motivation to continue doing research on this is now also because I think we do not solve the problems in the world by merely pointing our fingers to the perpetrators and locking them up. It doesn't make the world necessarily much safer. What does make the world much safer is we manage to prevent mass atrocities. So then my understanding, if everyone can become a perpetrator, we need to understand how and under what circumstances and what their responses are, and then change that. So that is now what keeps me interested in this and finding ways of disseminating my knowledge in finding concrete ways of doing that.
Your research led you also to Rwanda, where you see many ordinary people and many civilians who committed genocide in groups. There you also saw very much the othering that you were talking about, us versus them. Was that group pressure a situation, or was it lots of factors in between? How would you explain the Rwanda genocide in a way?
A lot of factors play a role in that. Yes, group pressure, absolutely. But also the other factors I said before, the fact that there was an ongoing war and there was a truce in the war. But then the plane crashed and this whole ideology got like, we are under attack. And I remember very well when I talked to some of the perpetrators, they told me, well, you cannot understand why we did what we did, because times were different back then. That made it clear to me also what they meant. Back then, they lived in this context where they felt like, okay, something is happening, which is out of our control. We need to do something. We need to protect ourselves. And that is what they believed. I'm not saying it was really the case. I'm just saying they believed. And for perpetrators, to understand their behavior, we have to understand their perception. And they perceived the situation as being in danger. They have to take up weapons in their own hands. And that made them attack the Tutsis and actually contribute or participate in the genocide. Within that context, the social pressure absolutely plays a huge role in group pressure more specifically, because in Rwanda is one of the episodes of mass atrocities where a lot of civilians participated. Well, that was because you had these groups of 10 or 100 killer groups or in between. And usually there were about 2-3 people that were actively physically involved in the killing. But all the others played a role by pointing out where they lived, by cheering them on, by stealing from the victims and all these other factors. And I think that genocide, even more so than the others, but many others see that as well, is how much we are affected by the people around us. Because even neighbors, friends, people who got along very well in the past started to kill each other. Because many people are just too afraid to go against a group or to stand out and say, hey, stop, we're doing the wrong thing. And that's also why I always say it's not that we're inherently evil, but we're much more weak. Too weak to stand up against a group and say, hey, stop, this is wrong, what we're doing. And to get everyone out of that social context where you start to believe that this is what you have to do, because that is what perpetrators ultimately believe. And I also think that is the reason why they told me you cannot understand. Because now they themselves, being in a different context, could also maybe hardly understand that back then in that context, they thought it was necessary and right to kill Tutsis.
I'm just going to head back again to the title of the pod, which I think is a quote from Hannah Arendt, who famously observed the trial of Adolf Eichmann in Israel. And we actually did a book club podcast on some of her writing, I remember. And we're really all fascinated by some of these big figures like Eichmann. And That quote, again, is that, again, a suggestion we could all have been Eichmann? Is that what Arendt is saying, or what do you think she's saying there?
I think she meant especially that the normality, the banality of evil, what the title of her book is. So I like that title very much, and it being very much debated what exactly she meant by it, because in her first version of the book, it was only the title. And I think in the last page, she mentioned the banality of evil once. But what I see in this sense of the banality of evil is the essence of terribly and terrifyingly normal, that you don't have to be an evil person driven by very evil, bad motives to become a perpetrator. Within a destructive system, it can be certain choices and features like being obedient, conformist, loyal, nationalist, wanting to make a career. These very ordinary character traits that many people show, but if you show them in a destructive and evil system like Nazi Germany, well, then you become an instrument of evil within that system. And I always love this quote, terribly and terrifyingly normal, because it is scary. Because as you said, we want to distance ourselves from that type of violence and those perpetrators. And yet, if we very clearly look, we could do the same. We could get involved as well. Going back to your question, can we all become Eichmanns? I think not necessarily an Eichmann, but we could all become perpetrators. And the entire idea of the typology of perpetrators is to show the dynamic between the situation and the individual, that we could all get involved in a period of mass atrocities under particular circumstances, but we would do so in different ways. Some people would be like Eichmann, but other peoples would be like different types of perpetrators. So there is the difference.
So now we're going to circle back to my coffee table theory, the ex-Bosnian waiter principle. And this is that when I was covering the ICTY, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, we at some point realized that a lot of the perpetrators we were talking about, that the most horrible things, they would always have been a waiter before the war. And at some point, me and a colleague who were covering all these trials were like, oh God, you know, as soon as somebody says, well, before the war, I was a waiter, we would brace ourselves. You know, you had normal, well, quote unquote, normal guys who were the guards in detention camps, former police officers and stuff like that. And then you had the ex-waiters who were the guys who would come in for fun to beat up prisoners and things like that. And I wonder, does it make any sense? Is there anything to having a more subservient job before a conflict and have this conflict that primes you to be more of a perpetrator or a more cruel perpetrator? Or is that just complete nonsense? And am I defaming Bosnian ex-waiters?
No, I do definitely think that the period of mass atrocities is so different from an ordinary life. If you live through a war, if there's a revolution, is there a lot of violence in the surroundings where you live in, that has a tremendous effect. And what we indeed see is that people who are very law-abiding before a period of war, the waiter in your example, they could absolutely become perpetrators during a period of war. However, what I said, not everyone is normal and ordinary. Amongst the perpetrators, there are also criminals who had been involved in crime and criminal activity, who then see a period of war as their chance to further their criminal activities. And there are many examples of that too. There are also people who were, before a period of war, were very violent and aggressive. Some have mental deficiencies. And some of these people also are happy with a period of war because then they can outlive their violent urges, their sadism. So there are people like that. And I also have to say that some of those people manage to get to play an important role in a period of violence. So within groups, they might be the one to direct the group towards becoming more violent. So that absolutely happens. And therefore, it's important to look, were they really law-abiding people before the war or not? But the fact that we have a certain group like that doesn't mean that there are not also many law-abiding people who could indeed get involved, who are then too scared to stand up, who focus just on their own job, who feel sometimes in the beginning powerless because it doesn't matter what they do, horrible things will happen anyway. So yes, you have these different types. There's also a third group, which I call the borderline ones. That are the ones who maybe before a period of war would be the bullies, the people pushing it, the people always on the borderline of what is legitimate and illegitimate. So maybe officially they're still law-abiding, but they're always pushing the borders. And that is also a group that in a period of mass atrocities is happily going over these boundaries because suddenly violence seems okay and violence can be committed on behalf of a country for very good goals and values.
I promise the listeners that shortly we will get to the full typology because I feel we're circling round it again and again here. But just before we do, I wanted to point out that we're recording this in March. We'll be putting it out in April. And we've just had the award for the Oscars this year, which included The Zone of Interest getting Best Foreign Film, which is set against the backdrop of Auschwitz, literally, but focuses on Hess, the commander of Auschwitz, and his family. I'm going to go and see it tonight and just give a quick shout out to the British Embassy in Vilnius that's putting it on. Thank you very much for inviting me. So I'm just asking again, here we go, asking again about another Nazi. What kind of perpetrator was Hess?
Rudolf Hess was the camp commander of Auschwitz, and I would qualify him as a devoted warrior. He was very obedient, conformist type of perpetrator. But he also was a guy who wanted to make a career, wanted to do things well, wanted to show how good he was, how well he was up to his job. And in doing that, he fully internalized, ultimately, the Nazi ideology and fully accepted it. So I don't think he was driven primarily by anti-Semitism or hatred, but he totally accepted that because that was the prevailing ideology and that was the job he got in the position he got. So I qualify him in the same category as, for instance, Eichmann and several others like Eugène de Kock and Doig, who were all people who didn't start off with that hatred, who might have been the perfect employees in any other organizations, but then became the perfect instruments in a very destructive and violent regime, and by internalizing the ideology. So ultimately, he did internalize. And the movie, I can absolutely recommend it because it shows very well the two sides of a perpetrator. And Robert J. Lifton once called it doubling, meaning that they have this one side where they show their cruelty, they join in the genocide, and then the other side where they have a regular family life and very ordinary things in their family. And this movie is excellent by portraying the family life, but yet you never see, but you hear and you know what's going on around it. And that shows to what extent people can deny reality. And that is what perpetrators do. They deny the fact that they're perpetrators. All of them see themselves as protecting their fatherland, fighting for a better world, doing the right thing. Hardly anyone sees themselves as a perpetrator, and Hess certainly didn't see himself as a perpetrator.
Now, you identify 14 different types of perpetrators, and we'll name them, but we also want to ask which are most relevant for the kinds of international crimes we're dealing with. So you identify the criminal mastermind, the careerist, the profiteer, the fanatic, the devoted warrior, the professional, the criminal and sadist, the follower, the compromised perpetrator, the holy warrior, the true believer, a predator, deranged, and avenger. Now, this sounds like the next series of Marvel movies and definitely some Hollywood cliches. Is any one of those more prevalent in the types of international crimes that we see at the courts that we deal with, do you think?
Well, the ones that are most important, and we've seen some of them in the courts, are the criminal masterminds. Those are the ones at the top of the chain of command. And those are the ones who are very responsible for creating the context in which other people commit the crimes. Now, of course, a criminal mastermind cannot do that by himself. So criminal masterminds needs other people, needs a fertile breeding ground. But once they have this fertile breeding ground and the support of others, they are crucial. So they play the most important role. And I think they are the worst perpetrators, the crucial ones. Closely working with the criminal masterminds are what I call their close associates. And that are the fanatics and the careerists. The fanatics are much more driven by an ideology, contempt, hatred. So they very strongly believe in the ideology. An example from Nazi Germany would be Goebbels. Whereas you also have the careerists. The careerists are much less driven by the ideology, but they want to make themselves a career. They want fame, power, status, earn their spot in history. Examples would be Goering and Speer from Nazi Germany. So that group, the three of them, are very, very important and crucial. I do think we should focus on the fact that to what extent they create the context, which is very important because they set the standards, they set the direction. Amongst the perpetrators, the ones that are most prevalent, I would say, are the profiteers and the followers. Profiteers are the people who can profit from what is going on. So they say, okay, this is going on. Whether I agree or not, it will happen. Let me take advantage of it. That is what quite a lot of profiteers do. So the largest group would be the profiteers. But then you also have a large group, the followers, who just go along because everyone goes along. And they don't have this very specific motive like ideology or self-interest, material gain or fear. They just do as the others do. So that will be the most important groups, I would say. Yet there are certain types of perpetrators that are maybe less prevalent, but do play a very important role. And one example is the devoted warrior. I mentioned it before already. People like Eichmann, Doig, Eugène de Kock, Alfredo Astiz, Rudolf Höss that we just discussed, I would qualify as devoted warrior. They rise to certain positions of power, are strongly initially driven by obedience, conformity. They want to be part of that organization, but then internalize the ideology. And they go beyond the call of duty to fulfill their tasks, to do as they are told, even if at a certain point they might not entirely believe in it anymore. And they play a very crucial role. As we all know, Eichmann played a very crucial role in Nazi Germany, and Doig played a crucial role in Cambodia. So there are less maybe of them, but they play crucial roles. And the same is true for certain perpetrators, the deranged ones, the predators, and the criminals, because for them, they have a very low threshold to violence. They've been involved in violence before the war. That means that they have little problem committing horrendous acts of violence. And that means that they can play a crucial role in making the entire situation becoming more violent, more aggressive. Yeah, there may be less of them. In literature, it is assessed about 5% are deranged or sadistic, but these 5% are fairly prominent.
Do you actually have any sympathy with your perpetrators that you study? We did a book club episode the American journalist academic Jessica Stern did interviewing Radovan Karadzic from Bosnia, where she, I mean, how to put it politely, basically she fell in love with her perpetrator that she was interviewing in some way. I mean, she really started to have this very interesting sort of back and forth relationship with him. Do you like your perpetrators?
No, I don't like them, but I also don't agree with your analysis of Jessica Stern, who is not a journalist, but a very well-established academic and scholar. And what I feel happened in that book, Jessica Stern has interviewed many perpetrators and mostly terrorists. So she is a very well-known terrorist expert, but slightly new to, let's say, genocide studies. And I found the fact that she went to Karadzic and tried to understand why he committed those crimes, very brave attempt. And what you see, yeah, you call it falling in love. That's absolutely not what happened, I think. What did happen, and that's why I find her book insightful, is that you could see from her dynamic and discussions with Karadzic how charismatic he was and how she, yes, to a certain extent, fell for his charisma, but also wanted to show that and share that with the public. And that happened. I therefore think it's a very insightful book. The one point where I'm more critical about the book is that she should, at some point, made it clearer that she didn't really believe what he said, denying genocide, but that genocide actually really happened. That should have been much clearer in the book. We had her on our podcast and discussed this with her on our podcast. And she really underestimated the consequences of the book because she is known to interview bad guys. So she felt, I don't have to point out that he is a bad guy. And I want to show how he manipulates people, how he wins people over, how his charisma affects people. And that she did in a powerful way. But then being new in the field of genocide scholars, where people were a bit less aware that she only interviewed really bad guys, it backlashed and people accused her of almost denying the genocide, which was absolutely not her intent. Yeah, it's a bit unfortunate that all this happened that way and that it wasn't clear what she really meant to do. But what I see, the strength of the book, how charismatic Karadzic is. So from her book, we can also learn the power of a man like Karadzic and how people fall for him and how he manages to manipulate people. And he manipulated people in committing genocide. So yes, he can manipulate a scholar trying to understand him. And that is what he did. So you get a very good insight in that.
For me, one of the things of that book is that she seemed to be woefully unprepared for meeting a politician. And maybe that's also the difference between interviewing terrorists versus genocide perpetrators. To commit crimes on such a large scale and to get all these people to follow you, you need a lot of charisma to get that going. So when I read the book, I felt she just should have been very prepared for him to be an extremely charming man. It's part of the trait of politicians. And maybe if you're interviewing terrorists, they need to be somewhat iconic, but they don't need to get like appeal to a large bunch of people. They can appeal to a very fringe thing. Do you think that's a...
No, I do think she was prepared for that, but she also wanted to understand how that would happen. But the mistake she made, and we had a discussion with her that it was also her publisher who wanted to get the book out there and get attention with the book, who took away some of the nuances that she had put in there. And he thought, okay, this will get the attention to the book. But she really wanted to understand how charisma works and how charisma can draw you into something by letting her, to a certain extent, be drawn into it and then go back and write about it. But then the one mistake she made, and the publisher played a role in that, is taking away the nuance, making it clear like, okay, this is what we're going to show. This is undeniable. And this is what happened here. Somehow it got off in the wrong way. But I do think she was very, very prepared. And she's a very experienced scholar. And yes, there is a difference, as you say, between terrorists and politicians. But I found the book very insightful, as I said, as how charisma works and how Karadzic is known. And that is several of the perpetrators are known like that, especially the careerists are known as what they call chameleons. They change very much per situation and make others believe that they are the way the others want to see them or that is useful for them. Vladimir Putin is one great example of someone who got chosen because people thought he could be controlled, because he knew how to pretend, present himself as someone who can be controlled. Well, now we know he cannot be controlled. So these types of perpetrators, the careerists, and I qualify Karadzic as a clear careerist, are chameleons. And that is also what he used in that situation. And that is also what Jessica Stern showed with the book, how that functions, how it operates. That is insightful. But yes, if you do that, you make yourself vulnerable also to a certain extent. And the same happened a bit with Gita Sereni, who interviewed Albert Speer in the book His Battle with Truth. At some point, she was also captured and captivated by his story. And later it turned out that many of the things were not factually right. Yet that book too, even despite the fact that we know that things are factually wrong, it shows us the world of this manipulative perpetrator and what he does to people.
Alet, thank you so much for giving us some of your time and some of your insights. Just a couple of quick shout outs. That last question about the difference between dealing with terrorists and genocide perpetrators came from Lindis, who has joined us on the podcast. She's started as a new intern, so people might see her on the screenshot that we normally take in the end. And also just to give a shout out to our own Patreon, if anybody wants to hear Steph, me and Molly Quell being annoyed by some books and loving some others, then you can join us on our War Criminals book club separately. Steph.
We always finish the podcast with our asymmetrical haircuts questions. And the first one is always, did we not ask you something that you would like to tell us about?
The one thing, yes, I think about something. Why this knowledge is relevant for lawyers, as your podcast is meant mostly or listened to by lawyers or people within the field of international criminal justice. I do think the typology, which I present in my book, Perpetrators of Mass Atrocities, shows the different layers of perpetration and gives a better understanding. And I don't think that the topology could be used as a psychological or individual psychological assessment instrument, but rather as a theoretical framework that gives a better understanding. And I do think it's very useful for lawyers and policymakers alike to show where actually the real causes of the crime are and where the main responsibility and blameworthiness is. So this theoretical framework can help to much better assess individual criminal responsibility and to get a better understanding of that. Ultimately, each perpetrator is unique because the typology is prototypes, yet it does give this better overview. So I do hope that lawyers will also use it and get this understanding on how individuals function in a certain context, and to not merely see the context as an excuse, but also as a real cause of their behavior.
And we also like to ask people like you who've spent their time studying this field, if there's a particular trial or a particular process, an accountability process, because I'm thinking sort of wider, there could be some other things, maybe even a truth commission or a, you know, like the Gachacha process or something, or a trial that you always return to that you think is interesting to always teach about or to write about.
Yes, the one that I always go back to is the Adamovich case. The Adamovich case so clearly shows the difficult position he was in and what we can request of perpetrators. Should we ask of them to risk their own lives or not? And then the difference between really having a gun to your head, literally, or to not having that gun, but having internalized that gun within an oppressive system. So I still teach on the Adamovich case, and then also compare his role with the one of torturers who were trained in a very coercive environment. And I can recommend that to any scholar. It's about torture training during the Greek military regime. And there's a documentary on it called Your Neighbor's Son, available on the internet. And then you see how people, in fact, internalize that gun to your head. Those two questions are, for me, crucial. Like, should and can we hold someone like Adermidovich responsible, and why exactly? And then ask the same questions for someone who went through such a coercive training program.
I'm going to Stefapedia the Adamovich case for the listeners who are not so well versed in the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal. Adamovich was a soldier in the Bosnian Serb army, but he was himself a Croat, and he wound up being involved in the massacres in Srebrenica, in basically the firing squads. And he was so racked by remorse that he, in fact, handed himself into the Yugoslav tribunal and was put on trial. And his defense was that he was forced to do it because basically he said he refused. And his comrade said, well, if you refuse, you can join the line of men over there, ready to be shot and put in a ditch. And he then continued to shoot. And his argument was, I needed to shoot to survive. But in the end, the judges did convict him because they said he didn't literally have a gun at that point. So that is the kind of standard of what you need to show, that you really need to have a gun to your head with the trigger cocked, ready to shoot you, for it to be under duress. This is the case that looks at the duress requirement, which is sometimes an excuse or something that's not punishable under international law if you commit war crimes. But that is, has set the standard. But you talked about this Greek documentary, so we naturally slide into the last part of our asymmetrical questions, is what are you reading, listening to, watching? What would you recommend our listeners to read, watch, listen to?
I just want to point out before Alette answers, she has this huge, towering library of books behind her. So we're specifically interested, Alette, what's on actually on your bedside table as such? What's the other stuff or the current stuff that you're up to?
Yeah, the thing is, I realized that during work periods, I don't really find time to read for leisure. So I merely do that on holidays. And I keep interested in these books. But the ones I read, I make a distinction between the very scientific analysis ones and the ones that are more the biographies, because that are the stories of people. Well, the one by Rudolf Höss was one I read many years ago, but I found it really intriguing. And that might be a relevant one to recommend right now, taking that the zone of interest is a popular movie. So I get my relaxation time more from doing sports and traveling.
Thank you very much for the recommendations and for taking this time to talk to us. As you've already heard, almost every year one of us comes up with a reason to interview somebody about perpetrators. So I'm sure we will find something to maybe ask you back on. And in the meantime, if listeners want to know more about perpetrators, of course, there's Alette's own podcast as well, where she goes much deeper into her typology.
I'm going to put a marker up now for one on toxic masculinity and perpetrators sometime next year, because I think that that's something that I'm really intrigued by, and women and men and who does what and so on. So marker on that. Maybe we'll get round to it early next year, I hope.
For Women's Day, I suggest.
Okay. Thanks very much, Alette.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
This was Asymmetrical Haircuts, your international justice podcast, created and presented by Janet Anderson and Stephanie van den Berg. This episode has been recorded at home, but we'd like to give a shout out to our regular host, Humanity Hub in The Hague. Music is by audionautics.com, and you can find show notes and everything about the podcast on asymmetricalhaircuts.com. This show is available on every major podcast service, so please subscribe, give us a rating, and spread the word.